Gillian Crease, Exclusion or Solidarity, Vancouver Workers Confront the Oriental Problem. BC Studies, number 80, Winter, 1988-89. Vancouver, from its very beginnings, it may be stated, has always been thoroughly anti-Chinese in its sentiments. Quote, the Chinese question was then constantly before the Vancouver Trades and Labor Council, and many motions were made on the various phases of the question, end quote. The history of labor politics in early 20th century British Columbia was marked by periods of intense anti-Asian agitation. Although the labor movement is commonly seen as an indication of developing working-class consciousness, white workers' consciousness of common working-class interest in British Columbia did not extend to Asian workers. This leads us to the question, why the white labor movement followed a strategy of excluding rather than including Asian workers in attempts to collectively improve their lives in British Columbia. Those who have attempted to answer this question have focused on two different factors, social psychology and economic competition. W. Peter Ward is the strongest proponent of the psychological approach, suggesting that the quote-unquote Oriental problem was fundamentally a product of the social psychology of race relations. At the bottom of West Coast radicalism lay the frustrated vision of a white British Columbia. Ward sees ideas as historically free-floating and therefore sufficient explanation for social action. This argument is premised on the sociological untenable assumption that social structures are primarily the outcome of the conscious creation of the human mind. The relationship between human agency, social structures, and ideas is a reflexive social process in which people are both the products and the producers of their social environment. Ideological factors are important for understanding racism, but it's necessary to consider the social context in which ideas have efficacy in specific historical times and places. The more common explanations for racial exclusion by white workers focus on economic factors, either alone or in combination with psychological or cultural differences. For Paul Phillips, Thomas Loosemore, Ross McCormack, Rennie Warburton, and Robert Wynne, economic competition between high-wage white workers and low-wage Asian workers explains racial exclusion by white workers. These authors agree that labor competition was the central feature of ethnic divisions in the working class, and that exclusion was the only viable strategy under those circumstances. Exclusion was the only viable strategy because Asians were, as they suggest, unorganizable. As McCormack argues, Asians were unassimilated and therefore impossible to organize. Two factors make this explanation weak. White workers did not try to organize Asians and then exclude the latter when organization failed. And Asian workers showed greater involvement in labor militancy than conventional wisdom allows, suggesting that solidarity with Asians was a possible alternative to exclusionary practices. The exclusion of Asian workers was not, then, the automatic outcome of competition in the labor market. Other factors, such as the denial of political rights to Asians and their status as permanent foreigners, were important considerations that shaped the practices of white workers. Other authors have attempted to combine economic and ideological explanations. Patricia Roy and Carlos Fuentes both argue that racism has two distinct loci, economic competition and the ideology of racism, or in Roy's words, fear for the future of a white British Columbia. Neither considers the relationship between economic and ideological factors, however, so an integrated analysis is undeveloped. David Berkusen and H. Claire Pentland consider cultural differences as immigrants from different ethnic origins compete with one another. Pentland argues that large numbers of low-status immigrants led to lack of solidarity, while few low-status immigrants facilitated labor radicalism. British Columbia is placed in the latter category, ignoring the coexistence of radicalism and anti-Asian exclusion. Berkusen suggests that the key to intra-working class conflict was immigrants' different expectations before arriving in Canada. Asians were cheap and docile because they faced worse conditions in their countries of origins and expected nothing better than they found in Canada. while European, especially British immigrants, expected better conditions and were radicalized. Berkusen does not explain why radicalized white workers excluded rather than included Asians as a solution to cheap labor competition. He also seems to assume that Asian docility gave white workers no choice but exclusion. What follows is a case study of patterns of racial exclusion and solidarity among one group of workers, an attempt to analyze the circumstances that shape such actions. Practices of Asian exclusion and inclusion within the Vancouver labor movement are explored in the period prior to the Second World War. Racial divisions within the working class reflected the importance of race in defining workers' lives, not only in the workplace, but also in the political sphere, in civil society, and in prevailing ideologies through which people understood their lives. Race appeared more or less salient in workers' understanding of their lives and problems under different circumstances. As the following analysis will attempt to show, white workers' treatment of Asian workers varied with economic conditions, adherence to radical political ideologies, and the participation of Asian workers in labor conflicts. The white labor movement often pursued anti-Asian activities in the period before the Second World War. Yet radical solidarity grew during periods of heightened labor radicalism and Asian labor militancy, especially during the Great Depression, even though competition for jobs was at its most intense. At such times, white workers were no longer distinguished Asians as foreigners, whose exclusion would advance the real white workers. They were seen as members of the Vancouver working class with interests similar to other workers. Patricia Roy, W. Peter Ward, Edgar Wickberg, Tian Fang Cheng, Peter Lee, Ken Adachi, and others have documented the pervasiveness of racism against Asians during the early 20th century. Racism was expressed both through dominant ideologies about the inferiority of non-Europeans and through discriminatory practices in the labor market, in the political system, and in most areas of daily life. Asians were not equal to whites in the province during the first half of the century, either in popular consciousness or in the social institutions of the society. Racial inequality was firmly linked to, and much acrimony rested upon, the role of Asians as cheap wage laborers in the economy. The push and pull of Asian immigration was tied to their status as wage laborers. The first large-scale migration of Chinese recruited by the Canadian Pacific Railway was precipitated by the demand for cheap labor, and Chinese, Japanese, and East Indian migrants actively sought entry into Canada in pursuit of wage labor opportunities. With a small indigenous population, immigration filled economic development needs, and the motivations for emigration were little different for European or Asian immigrants. Immigrants of all kinds sought better economic opportunities, and the vast majority would find those opportunities laboring for someone else. Capitalism was, or remains, a central organizing feature of Canadian society, and immigration patterns were, and are, closely linked to the demands of capitalist economic development. What differentiated Asian migrants from Europeans was not only the precise role that the former played in the labor market as an underclass of cheap laborers, but also their being denied political rights by the Canadian state. The mostly male Asian workers were largely confined to the least desirable unskilled labor and concentrated in the primary and service sectors of the economy, earned from one-half to three-quarters of the wages of unskilled white men in the same industries, and were typically hired under labor contractors rather than as individuals, a system that added to their lower standard of living and segregation from the white labor force. Low wages and restricted employment opportunities were directly related to the second-class political status accorded Asians in Canada. Unlike other immigrants, Asians were denied the rights of political citizenship, restricted in areas of employment, regulated, taxed, and even prohibited from immigration to Canada. In its policies, the Canadian government clearly distinguished between desirable white settlers and Asian migrants who would be encouraged to work but not settle in Canada. Asians were considered unassimilable, permanent foreigners, irrespective of naturalization or place of birth. the different treatment Asian and European immigrants received from employers and the Canadian state created the racially stratified society. Asian subordination was an integral part of social relations in British Columbia. As a result, class relations were shaped by practices of white domination and Asian subordination. Class relations of power and domination derived from the rights of private property and the pursuit of profit central to a capitalist economy, and were part of the daily life, if not always daily consciousness, of all who labored in the province. Although class inequality was common to all wage laborers, however, practices attributed to the race and the gender of the worker shaped the nature of the subordination. To a considerable extent, racial and gender characteristics define the type of work available, the wages received for the work, the ability to acquire various kinds of skills, and even conditions in the workplace. White men monopolized the skilled trades and received higher wages than other workers in unskilled labor. Some work was clearly classified as woman's work, another work as coolie labor, sometimes with overlapping boundaries. Workers in British Columbia were not, then, neutral units of labor power. They were hired as white or Asian workers, male or female workers, and were treated differently by employers. In a society where racial and gender characteristics define the nature of citizenship and political rights, women and Asian workers were socially defined as more exploitable than white male workers. It should not be surprising, then, that both race and gender affected the development of the labor movement in British Columbia, a movement dominated by white men, the strongest segment of the working class. The Vancouver Trades and Labor Council, VTLC, founded in November of 1889, was the center of the Vancouver labor movement and the center of working class anti-Asian activity. The quote-unquote Oriental problem was constantly before council during its early years, as a review of its first year of operation shows. In February, the VTLC supported an agreement between the City of Vancouver and Rogers Sugar Refinery, granting the latter tax concessions in exchange for an all-white hiring policy. In September 1890, the VTLC pursued a boycott of Chinese laundries and enforcement of Sunday closing bylaws against Chinese businesses. In October, VTLC delegates attended the Trades and Labor Congress convention in Ottawa to express their views on the danger of Chinese immigration and met with Prime Minister John A. Macdonald to demand an increase in the Chinese head tax from $50 to $500. In November, VTLC formed a committee to investigate and compile statistics on Chinese labor to be used in its agitation for stricter immigration laws. And in April of the following year, the VTLC adopted a resolution calling for the total prohibition of Chinese immigration to Canada. Individual unions within the Labor Council regularly complained of cheap Chinese and later Japanese and East Indian competition undermining union workers. In a single council meeting on the 4th of June 1908, for example, three different unions identified Asian competition as the cause of poor labor conditions for the union concerned. The Tailors Union reported, quote, "Trade dull, Chinese competition displacing membership. Delegates urge the demand for their label, the only guarantee that their clothes were made outside Asiatic sweatshops and non-union premises," end quote. The Cooks and Waiters Union reported, quote, "Asian competition was a continual menace to their organization. Complaint that white cooks could not be secured was due to the higher wages demanded. Many members out of employment, trade very dull," end quote. The Typographical Union reported on the existence of Chinese and Japanese print shops doing work for patriotic local businessmen that were putting union members out of work. Two motions were passed at the meeting concerning Asian competition. One motion was directed to the Provincial Attorney General to find out, quote, "why the Asiatic population is not compelled to comply with the civic health bylaws the same as others," and urged that prompt measures be taken to see that the Chinese disease-breeding sweatshops be at least cleaned up and made to comply with the law, end quote. The VTLC executive was directed to inquire why Japanese establishments were granted liquor licenses. Although all VTLC meetings were not as preoccupied with the Oriental problem as this meeting in June 1908. Asian competition was a recurring concern for the Council. The VTLC and its union affiliates engaged in numerous forms of anti-Asian activities. Exclusionary labor practices include boycotts against Asian businesses, campaigns to replace Asian labor with white labor, to disallow the employment of white women alongside Asian men, to restrict areas of Asian employment, areas of Asian residence, and the hours that Asians could work, to prohibit further Asian immigration, and to prohibit Asian membership in trade unions. The labor movement tended to equate non-union labor with Asian labor, even though only a minority of white workers were unionized. And while cheaper Asian labor was criticized for undermining union workers, Asian workers were explicitly excluded from membership in trade unions. Concern with cheap Asian labor competition was pressed most strongly by unions faced with direct Asian competition, especially tailors, garment workers, laundry workers, and restaurant workers. The skilled craft unions, which made up the bulk of the VTLC membership, were not often in direct competition with Asian workers, although skilled unions perceived potential Asian competition in their industries as a threat. For the unskilled unions, Asian labor competition was often a preoccupation, especially during periods of high unemployment. The minutes of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, for example, record persistent denunciations of union men patronizing unfair restaurants, referring to restaurants and hotels employing Chinese cooks, waiters, or busboys, rather than non-union establishments employing whites. Chinese waiters and cooks were identified as the major impediment to more successful union organizing in the culinary industry. The Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union actively supported the Asiatic Exclusion League and tried repeatedly to persuade City Hall to tie licenses to white-only hiring clauses and to disallow the employment of white women in Chinese restaurants. The union also directly lobbied hotels and restaurants to replace Chinese employees with whites in return for union patronage of their establishments. The Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union did not try to include Chinese restaurant workers as a solution to cheap labor competition until 1938, when a Chinese union organizer was hired. The labor movement's rationale for excluding Asians was based not only on cheap labor competition, but also included explicitly racist ideas. Asians were considered inferior social beings, Japs, Chinks, Coolies, Hindus, insidious Orientals. Just as the Canadian state distinguished between Asian immigrants without political rights and whites who would become real Canadians with political rights, so too did the labor movement define Asian workers as foreigners and whites as the real working class in Canada. Critiques of the oppression of workers were often linked to demands to hire citizens of one's own race. In 1907, a petition was circulated among upper-class women to repeal the $500 Chinese head tax because it contributed to a scarcity of servants in the city. In the VTLC's response to this petition, the importance of race is central to the definition of the working class. Quote, "Thus we urge the present government to disregard the petition of those ladies of British Columbia who want Chinese servants. The women of the working class do their own work, and when they need help, they employ their own race. Let these ladies who now waste their time in useless functions emulate the example of their poorer sisters and do a little of their own domestic work. If, however, they claim immunity from work, let them pay the price or modify the conditions of service in such a manner as will secure for them girls of their own race. It is, we think, absurd that the working class of Canada should run the risk of having its standard of living degraded to the level of a Chinese coolie, merely to gratify the whim of an aristocratic lady for a Chinese servant." End quote. For the labor movement, the essential factor defining membership in the Vancouver working class was not, apparently, union membership, length of residence, or Canadian versus foreign birth. It was race. Asians were considered non-assimilable foreigners, who were undermining the living standard of real white workers in British Columbia. The problem was not immigration per se, but the type of immigration into British Columbia. Quote, "The demand for Asiatic exclusion cannot be answered by a counter-demand for the exclusion of all immigration, upon the grounds of equal treatment to the peoples of all nations. Admitting that European immigration, as it has recently developed, constitutes a problem demanding immediate attention, it is, after all, a problem of quantity, whereas Asiatic immigration is distinctly a problem of quality, end quote. The prevalence of racist attitudes about the inferiority of Asian workers in British Columbia was grounded in the social organization of Asians as cheap wage laborers at the bottom of the class structure, and the state's denial of citizenship rights. Racism was part of the dominant ideology of the period, a legacy of British colonialism, which found salience in the conditions of workers' lives since employment practices were explicitly race-conscious. White workers' experiences included witnessing the expansion of cheaper Asian labor in the primary and service sectors of the economy as employers sought to drive down the practice of labor and undermine union organization. As an article in the British Columbia Federationist suggested, white workers feared that the long-term effect of this competition threatened to undermine their already inadequate living standards. Quote, "It has been proved time and time again that when the Oriental once again gets foothold in a certain line, the standard of wage in that field at once drops because of his basing his wage demands according to his standard of living. It is not a case of possibly raising the Oriental to the white standard. It is a case of the certain lowering of the standard of the whites." End quote. In the context of a racially segregated labor market, the strongest segment of the working class, white, male workers, organized to exclude rather than include cheaper and politically weaker workers who were already defined as foreigners within Canadian civil society. In order to overcome racial exclusion, white workers had begun to define Asian workers as part of the working class rather than as foreigners who were the cause of the former's insecurity. During two brief periods between the First and Second World Wars, when many organized white workers pursued greater solidaristic practices with Asian workers, the labor movement did not begin to redefine Asians as part of the Vancouver working class. At the end of the First World War, 1917 to 1921, and during the Great Depression, the two most militant periods of Vancouver labor history, some white labor organizations actively set out to organize with Asians rather than against them. It was also during these periods that Asian workers were most actively involved in labor militancy. Asian workers were always in a weaker position than the white workers in Vancouver. They were less likely to engage in labor militancy and more vulnerable when they did so. This is not surprising. Asian workers lacked political and citizenship rights, possessed fewer economic resources than white workers, lacked well-developed trade union socialist traditions, faced the resistance of the ethnic community elites dominated by Asian employers, and were the object of exclusionary practices by white trade unions. Nevertheless, the image of Asians as strikebreakers but never labor activists during the early years of the labor movement is exaggerated. Although much less active in labor conflicts than white workers, there was a thread of Asian labor activism in Vancouver throughout the early 20th century. In the Greater Vancouver area, Chinese, Japanese, and East Indian workers took part in no fewer than 50 separate strikes between 1900 and 1939. 70% of these strikes involved the joint action of Asian and white workers, mostly in the lumber industry and the fisheries. Two-thirds of the strike involving Asians were concentrated in two periods. Asian workers struck 12 times at the end of the First World War and 20 times during the Great Depression, 1921 to 1937. In contrast, Asians engaged in only 13 strikes during the first 16 years of this century and in only 6 strikes between 1922 and 1930. It is not coincidental that higher levels of Asian labor militancy occurred simultaneously with greater solidaristic practices by white workers. The position of Asian workers was strengthened considerably by common action with white workers, thereby encouraging Asian labor militancy. And the more militant Asians were in the workplace, the more likely that white workers would recognize their common interests and attempt to unite with Asian co-workers. For all workers, the state of the economy shaped labor activism. The labor shortages at the end of the First World War strengthened the position of all workers. While the depth of the economic crisis during the 1930s had a general radicalizing effect, these three interrelated factors, economic conditions, the growth of radical labor politics, and increased Asian militancy, resulted in greater racial solidarity at the end of the First World War and during the Great Depression. There were, of course, instances of Asian-white cooperation during strikes in the period prior to the First World War, especially, but not exclusively, in the salmon fishery. Whatever cooperation occurred, however, was short-lived, lasting only during a particular labor conflict, and never involved organizational inclusion. Lack of organizational unity weakened joint strike activity, and employers often found it possible to break strikes by forcing weaker Asians back to work. White workers gave little consideration to the weaker economic and political position of Asian workers, and simply branded the latter as strike breakers. In the fisheries, for example, the areas where Japanese fishermen could fish were restricted, while white and native fishermen could fish throughout the coast. This had a profound effect on labor conflicts in that industry. As one Japanese fisherman remembered, Japanese fishermen could not strike for long, because if they lost the season in their area, they could not go elsewhere to recoup as other fishermen. This made Japanese fishermen the weak link in the chain, in spite of their commitment to improving fish prices and frequent involvement in fishery strikes. When economic necessity forced the Japanese back to work, white native fishermen simply branded the Japanese as strikebreakers, even though the whites and natives were instrumental in enforcing restrictive regulations against Japanese fishermen in the first place. On rare occasions, some white labor organizations advocated organizing Asian workers as a solution to cheap labor competition. In 1903, the Western Federation of Miners suggested organizing Chinese coal miners to forestall strike breaking during the Canadian Pacific Railway strike, but nothing came of it. The WFM's successor, the International Workers of the World, also on occasion suggested organizing Chinese workers, but apparently never acted on the idea. Apart from these two industrial unions, no other unions even considered Asian organization a possibility. Exclusionary politics were much less prevalent in the more radical industrial unions and in the socialist political parties in the province than in the mainstream labor movement, even before the First World War. The dominant socialist organization in British Columbia during the first two decades of this century was the Socialist Party of Canada, SPC. Like other labor representatives, SPC members of the Legislative Assembly supported legislation discriminating against Asians in the workplace and restricting further Asian immigration. But while endorsing the labor movement's call for the abolition of Asian immigration, socialists also cautioned that this would not solve the labor problem. Only the abolition of capitalism would accomplish that end. As the Western Clarion suggested, quote, "Organized workers are even now making loud complaints against what they term the Sikh invasion. They are calling upon the powers that be to put a stop to it. They overlook the fact that the powers to whom they appeal and the property interests which profit by the influx of this cheap and docile labor are identical. Their appeal thus of necessity must fall upon deaf ears. If the workers of this or any other country desire the exclusion of people from other lands, they must first take possession of the reins of government in order to effect their purpose and enforce their will. This race question is being agitated by the master class in order to delude the workers into participating in a trade war for their master's benefit. The longer that the hope of betterment by emigration is before the workers, the longer they will be in discovering that their one common hope of betterment lies in the overthrow of the wage system," end quote. By the beginning of the First World War, the Socialist Party position on Asian workers had become clearly defined in the context of the international solidarity of all workers, and the politics of exclusion was rejected. Quote, "Why does it greatly matter who our masters import or exclude? We are slaves here. We are slaves in China or Japan, so our conditions can be changed, but slightly while the capitalist system lasts. We are not of any nationality. We are not white or black. But one thing suffices to make us all common. We are forced to sell labor power to another class in order to live." End quote. For those who embrace radical socialism, there could be little rationalization for excluding some workers, whether socially defined as foreigners or not, from the collective working class when the abolition of the exploitation of all workers was the goal. Socialists more clearly defined the enemy as capitalist employers, not other workers. But as Robert MacDonald has recently pointed out, The labor movement in Vancouver was not dominated by socialists. It was dominated by moderate laborism. For the most part, Vancouver workers sought reform, not the abolition of capitalism. And one area where reform was pursued was the exclusion of foreign Asian workers from immigration to Canada and from more desirable jobs in the economy. While the Western Clarion was calling on workers to recognize that all workers were the victims of capitalism, the VTLC continued to pass motions seeking the abolition of Oriental labor in mines, lumbering, fishing, and railways, to legislate white labor clauses on public works projects, and for the renewal of hotel and restaurant licenses, and even to enforce segregated areas for Asian residents in Vancouver. However, the shortage of labor and high rates of inflation created by the First World War fostered labor militancy among Asian as well as white workers, and when combined with the growth of radical socialism after the war, produced increased solidaristic practices within the Vancouver labor movement for a brief period of time. The First World War marked a watershed in white Asian solidarity. The post-war period was marked by general strikes in Vancouver in 1918 and 1919, the rapid growth of support for the One Big Union, OBU, massive organization in the largely unorganized lumber industry, and labor confrontations throughout the province. Asian workers participated in militant labor conflicts, including the 1919 general strike, played dominant roles in some strikes, particularly in the lumber industry, and for the first time were admitted into some white labor unions. Chinese and Japanese workers also organized their own trade unions within the lumber industry. The first confrontation in which Asian workers played a dominant role during the war was the shingle weaver strike in the summer of 1917. Approximately 800 men, three-quarters of whom were Chinese, struck in dozens of shingle mills in the Lower Mainland for an 8-hour day with 10 hours pay. White workers were organized, separately, under the Shingle Weavers Union, and Chinese workers were organized under the Chinese Canadian Labor Union, formed the previous year. According to the Chinese Times, the White Union distributed leaflets in Chinese, urging the Chinese to organize for shorter hours. Once the strike began, however, Chinese workers were the main motivating force. As the British Columbia Federation has commented, quote, "Officials of the Shingle Weavers Union assert that if they were as sure of some of the married white workers as they are of the Chinese, there would be no difficulty in enforcing union conditions throughout the jurisdiction. Chinese employees asking for 2 cents more per thousand than the whites. However, it is possible that the whites may be able to get the Chinese to come to a more reasonable frame of mind. But at that, it's a sight for the gods." End quote. The strike was not successful, but it marked the beginning of large-scale organization among Asian workers in the lumber industry and greater cooperation with whites. In March 1919, Asian shingle weavers again launched a major strike in the industry. Approximately 1,200 Asian workers, mostly Chinese, struck up to 50 shingle mills in the Lower Mainland and on the coast to resist a 10% wage reduction. The strike lasted 1 month, with the old wage scale restored in April. In May, the Chinese Shingle Workers Union, formed during the strike, demanded and won a further wage increase. Incidents of this kind of Asian labor militancy led to calls for white workers to unite with Asians to improve the situation of all workers. By 1919, the British Columbia Federationist, formerly affiliated with the VTLC, had adopted an explicitly socialist politics and would encourage the growth of the One Big Union. The paper reflected and further encouraged greater Asian-white solidarity. Quote, "Yes, fellow workers, Asiatic workers should be encouraged as joining white unions, for it is a class problem and not a race problem that confronts the white mill workers of BC. It is time that all workers in Canada realize that the Chink is as much a part of this country as is the Scotchman, that the Bohunk is as necessary as the Englishman, that all of us are exploited by a master class who cares not what nationality we are so long as we remain willing slaves." End quote. Asian workers, especially those in the shingle and sawmills, took an active part in the 1919 general strikes in Vancouver and New Westminster. According to the Chinese Times, the VTLC promised to treat the Chinese workers well after the strike was over, and help the Chinese to fight against discriminatory laws. Asian workers also played an active role in many OBU organized strikes for the 8-hour day in the lumber industry during 1919 and 1920. In some instances, Asian workers were members of the Lumber Workers Industrial Union, OBU, although more commonly, joint labor agitation occurred with Asians organized separately in the Chinese Shingle Workers Union and the Japanese Workers Union. There were many instances of solidarity unparalleled in the past. In April 1920, for example, Chinese workers, at least some of whom were members of the OBU, struck Fraser Mills in Mellardville when a wage increase was refused. White workers quit work in solidarity with the Chinese, and a joint committee was formed that successfully negotiated a wage increase. The British Columbia Federationists commented that such incidents could help to educate white mill workers, who mistakenly believed that the reason they are so poorly paid is because they have to compete with Oriental labor. In this and other cases, the, quote, splendid solidarity evidenced in the way in which white workers, Japs, and Chinese stood together, end quote, was recognized as an important factor in the gains being made in the lumber industry. Labor gains did not last long. By 1921, the post-war recession was producing an onslaught of wage reductions, and the one big union and radical socialist politics dwindled almost as quickly as it had grown. The moderate laborism of the VTLC dominated Vancouver labor politics again, and with unemployment high and circumstances no longer advantageous for labor militancy among Asians or whites, Asian exclusion became a central focus of organized labor once again. In May 1921, the VTLC launched a Made in BC by Citizens of Canada campaign, suggesting that, quote, the time has arrived when the citizens must draw the line more closely between our own nationals and the aliens from other countries, particularly those from Asiatic countries with a lower standard of living, by replacing these men with returned men and citizens generally, with special regard for those who are suffering from handicaps incurred in the war. End quote. 2 weeks later, the council struck an Asiatic committee to gather data on Asian employment. In July, the committee reported that Asian immigration constitutes the most serious social menace facing the citizens of BC, and demanded that Asian immigration be prohibited. In August, the VTLC, 7 trade unions, 5 veterans associations, and the Retail Merchants Association formed the Asiatic Exclusion League at a meeting at the Labor Hall. The mandate of the Asiatic Exclusion League was threefold. 1. To educate the white population to the terrible menace of the Oriental immigration. 2. To pledge every candidate who is running for Dominion offices at the next election to give a stated policy for the exclusion of Orientals. 3. To press for immediate registration of all Orientals in British Columbia under the auspices of the government. Once the exclusion movement had succeeded with the passage of the Chinese Immigration Act in 1923, and the reduction of Japanese laborers to 150 per year, the council concentrated on replacing Asian workers with whites and boycotting Asian businesses. In 1921, the Japanese Workers' Union applied for affiliation with the VTLC but was turned down. 6 years later, and now the Japanese Camp and Mill Workers' Union, the first Asian union, became a member of the Vancouver Trades and Labor Council. This time, only 5 of the 25 unions that voted in the referendum on Japanese union affiliation objected to the latter's inclusion. Japanese affiliation indicated a greater degree of racial tolerance within the VTLC, but did not end exclusionary practices. The Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, the Bakers Union, the Domestic Workers Union, and the Shingle Weavers Union all undertook campaigns endorsed by the VTLC to replace Asian labor with white labor. And when the Canadian Labour Party endorsed the enfranchisement of Asians in the spring of 1928, the VTLC withdrew its affiliation after 32 of 36 unions voted against the motion in a referendum. Class conflict within the Japanese community was the main outcome of Japanese union affiliation with the VTLC. The Japanese Merchant Association condemned Japanese involvement in the trade union movement and mounted a campaign to weaken the Japanese camp and mill workers' union. Japanese employers fired members belonging to the union. Merchants withdrew all advertising from the union's newspaper, the Daily People, objecting to the paper's message that Japanese workers should unite against their employers. In response, the Japanese Camp and Millworkers Union organized a boycott of Japanese businesses and a food cooperative to supply their members' needs. Anti-union resistance by Asian employers, who are powerful members of the Asian community, probably mitigated greater Asian labor organization. In any event, Asian workers were involved in few strikes during the rest of the 1920s and still faced considerable anti-Asian activity among white workers. Although the Camp and Millworkers Union was a member of the VTLC, Asians were still not welcome in the white unions. As one Japanese labor activist commented, "Without the cooperation of the white unions, we could achieve nothing." As the economic crisis deepened and unemployment escalated during the early 1930s, labor militancy among whites and Asians and radical socialist politics grew. The social dislocation was so severe during the 1930s that for many workers, capitalism was clearly identified as the enemy, and solidarity between white and Asian workers was actively pursued. By the end of 1930, there were more unemployed in Vancouver than there were union members. The depth of unemployment generated two different forms for labor activism: the organization of the unemployed and its increasing demand for state action. And the organization of the unorganized, especially in the lumber industry again, under the Workers' Unity League, WUL. Both the organization of the unemployed and the WUL occurred under the auspices of the Communist Party of Canada. The VTLC became increasingly irrelevant to the labor activism during the Depression. Maintaining its stance of moderate laborism, the VTLC continued to pursue strategies to increase the security and standard of living of its employed members and remained separate from the unemployed organizations and from the dual unions that it condemned. The issue of unemployment did dominate council concerns, but until the late 1930s, one of its major solutions was to demand the exclusion of Asian workers in preference for the employment of whites. As the VTLC's newspaper, The Labor Statesman, often proclaimed, Asians should not be employed when thousands of Canadian boys were out of work. Moreover, it was up to the government to ensure the preferential hiring of whites. Quote, "The provincial government should also require that goods or materials needed for public works should not be purchased from firms employing Oriental labor," end quote. In spite of the persistence of the view in the mainstream labor movement that Asians were foreigners and not real Canadian workers, so the lives of the latter could be improved if the former were eliminated, the 1930s witnessed the breakdown of racial divisions in a more profound way than the brief post-war radicalism had. In the unions of the Workers' Unity League and in the National Unemployed Workers' Association, the umbrella organization for various unemployed groups, Asians were not only accepted as members, they were actively recruited as equals, and issues specific to Asian workers were placed on the labor agenda during conflicts. The National Unemployed Workers' Association called for the solidarity of all unemployed workers. Quote, "The unemployed do not recognize any difference of race or color. Among the many thousands of unemployed workers organized in the NUWA, there are many Oriental workers who are among the most highly respected in the organization," end quote. The situation faced by unemployed workers varied by marital status, race, and sex. Chinese workers, for example, were ineligible for city relief because almost all were single men, unlike the Japanese, and only married men qualified for city relief in the early years of the Depression. Unemployed Chinese workers were also ineligible for the relief camps for single men because they only accepted white men. Thus, Chinese workers found unemployment particularly difficult, and as the resources within the Chinese community were stretched beyond their limits, formed the Chinese Unemployed Workers Protective Association, CUWPA. CUWPA fought for the relief for the unemployed along with the Single Unemployed Protective Association, which organized single white men in Vancouver, and the Neighborhoods Council and Block Committees of the National Unemployed Workers Association, which organized married families, including Asian, mostly Japanese families. These organizations successfully pressed for city relief for destitute Japanese and, in at least one instance, Chinese families. They fought for equal relief rates for Asians and white families after the city of Vancouver deemed the former to require 20% less than the latter to live. They also lobbied for relief for single Chinese men and demanded, though unsuccessfully, improved conditions in a mission soup kitchen that was contracted to feed unemployed Chinese in 1933, but was so inadequate that over 100 Chinese men died of starvation by 1935. These organizations also demonstrated from time to time to reinstate Chinese men who were cut off further assistance. Solidaristic practices were not confined to issues of unemployment. Between 1931 and 1939, Asian workers were involved in at least 20 strikes in the Lower Mainland area, three-quarters of which were in sawmills and shingle mills. Nearly half of these strikes took place in a single year, 1932, when Asian workers took part in 8 strikes in local lumber mills. Most of these strikes were coordinated by the Lumber Workers Industrial Union, affiliated with the Workers' Unity League. During some of these labor conflicts, new demands for racial equality emerged. In September 1931, 600 white, Chinese, Japanese, and East Indian workers struck Fraser Mills in Mallardville over a reduction in wages. Organized under the WUL, the strikers demanded a 10% wage increase, equal pay for equal work, union recognition, and the abolition of the contract labor system for Oriental workers, and the immediate dismissal of the Japanese labor contractor. The demands in the strike illustrate the extent to which Asian workers were integrated as fuller members of the union and strike committee, especially the demands for equal pay and the abolition of the contract labor system. In August 1932, 50 white and Japanese workers struck at Sterling Shingle Mills in Vancouver for a 10% wage increase and the reinstatement of workers discharged for union organizing, most of whom were Japanese. According to the Lumber Worker, a WUL newspaper, this was the first strike where white workers went out in order to protect the jobs of Asian workers. In September 1933, 1,200 white and Japanese men and women organized under the WUL struck a Fraser Valley hop farm demanding a wage increase and better living conditions, especially improvements in the Japanese living quarters. The strike committee included Japanese and white representatives, with the Japanese initially demanding higher wages than the white strikers. Asian representation on the WUL strike committees was common. In fact, it was an intentional strategy of the union and often resulted in placing demands specific to Asian workers on the strike agenda. The most notable feature of Asian labor militancy during the 1930s was the degree to which Asians were included as equal members of, at least part of, the labor movement in comparison to previous periods. At the end of the 1930s, after the WUL unions had merged into the international labor movement, even some of the most vocal anti-Asian unions in Vancouver began to include Asian workers within their ranks. The Hotel and Restaurant Employees Union, for example, hired a Chinese labor organizer to help unionize Chinese cooks in 1938. Asian workers were by no means fully integrated into the Vancouver labor movement during the 1930s, but the shift towards the acceptance of Asians as equal workers and citizens, rather than as foreigners, was well underway within sections of the organized working class during the Depression. The events of the Second World War demonstrate that racial equality had not yet been accomplished. As the Depression ended with the Second World War, Japanese Canadians were again defined as the foreign enemy, not only by the Canadian state, but also by the white labor movement in British Columbia. The politics of the Vancouver working class reflect the heterogeneity of the conditions experienced by workers. The labor movement in Vancouver, as in all capitalist societies, emerged out of the struggle over control in the workplace and the political sphere. But employment practices were neither colorblind nor sexblind. Male, female, white, and Asian workers did not receive equal treatment in the labor market, by the state, or in civil society. The material realities of working-class life included relations of white domination and Asian subordination, and male domination and female subordination, that, to a large extent, defined conditions of work and wages, and the nature of citizenship rights within civil society. It is little wonder, then, that the working-class politics were structured by ethnic and gender relations of inequality. Labor competition was indeed central to racial divisions within the Vancouver working class, but labor competition is not sufficient to explain these divisions. Common assumptions that Asian exclusion was the only possible outcome of labor competition, while labor solidarity was impossible, are challenged by the foregoing analysis. The extent of Asian labor militancy before the Second World War shows that the assumptions about docile and unorganizable Asians are, at the very least, exaggerated. Moreover, it should be recognized that the actions of white workers thwarted greater Asian labor organization in the first place. It is reasonable to assume that Asians would have been even more active in labor struggles if white workers had been more open to cooperation with Asians. Furthermore, if labor competition was a sufficient explanation for exclusionary practices, we would expect such practices to be heightened during the Depression of the 1930s, when labor competition was most intense. Instead, racial solidarity was strongest during this period. A fuller explanation for racial divisions and the process of overcoming these cleavages must include attention to the subordinate status of Asians within civil society, patterns of Asian labor militancy, and changes in the political ideological orientation of white workers, since socialist and labor reformists pursued different strategies towards Asian workers. Asian workers formed a pool of cheap labor whose social status within civil society, established through state immigration policies and the denial of political rights, was as permanent foreigners. For white workers, whose own precarious existence was further threatened by cheaper Asian labor, the foreigner status of Asians led, at least for the majority who embraced labor reformism, to strategies of exclusion. As foreign workers, Asians were not considered part of the real white working class, whose common interests organized labor sought to represent. A pattern of ethnic divisions developed in Vancouver, whereby economically and politically stronger white workers sought to improve their lives by excluding Asian workers from better jobs and preferably from the country. Racist labor practices in turn reinforced the subordination of Asian workers in the labor market and in civil society and ensured their persistence as cheap labor. Asian labor militancy was hampered by lack of economic and political resources. The racist practices of organized white workers, and class conflict within the ethnic communities. Yet contrary to much of the literature on British Columbia labor history, there was a threat of Asian labor militancy throughout this century. At the end of the First World War, increased Asian labor activism was facilitated by the war-induced labor shortage and inflation, greater militancy among white workers, and the strengthening of socialist politics advocating solidarity with Asians. The severity of the Depression of the 1930s fostered even greater Asian labor activism, much of it organized by the Communist-led Workers' Unity League and the organizations of the unemployed. During the 1930s, Asian workers began to place their own issues on the political agenda, an indication of their inclusion as more equal members of the labor movement compared to earlier periods of cooperation. A necessary condition for bridging ethnic divisions among Vancouver workers was the redefinition of Asians as workers, like others in Canada, rather than as foreigners. The adoption of socialist politics, with its sharper focus on class divisions and solidarity among all workers, and evidence of common class interest shown through Asian labor activism, helped to break down ethnic divisions within working class politics, even though differential racist treatment by employers and the Canadian state and labor competition between white and Asian men persisted.